Hello, welcome to another episode of Theatre Voice, brought to you by the Victoria and Albert Museum. Michael Boyd was artistic director of the Royal Shakespeare Company from 2003 to 2012. He inherited an organisation in fairly dire financial straits and left it reaping the benefits of both Matilda the Musical and the newly refurbished Royal Shakespeare Theatre. In keeping with his Russian theatre training, he sought to reinstate the spirit of the ensemble there, putting the C back into RSC. It was that underpinned both his extraordinary history cycle and his expansive Complete Works Festival. This autumn, for the first time, Boyd's back in Stratford. His production of Christopher Marlowe's bloodthirsty two-parter in blank verse, Tamburlaine, has won critical acclaim across the board. It marries rigorous historical context with contemporary resonance. We sent the critic Dominic Cavendish along to find out more.
I'd come back to the RSC a great deal in 2013 because I'd programmed the year. So I felt a sense of duty to come in, sort of with my collar up and dark glasses on, just to see the shows, go backstage, say well done, and bugger off. because it was funny going back then, because you still felt you hadn't lost the sense of responsibility, but you didn't have it. So it was an awkward experience. And because of that, that disjoint, in a way, I didn't want to go back and do something for a bit. Also, I think, putting myself in Greg's shoes, I would want to be left alone for a bit. And it wasn't the first time I remember going back to Stratford. I went back for various reasons in the meantime. My son was in the company and did some beautiful stuff there, so obviously I went to see him. But the first time I went back where I didn't feel, oh goodness, you know, there's so many people whose situations I must be thinking about, whose names I must remember, you know, and there are bound to be issues in the company and I don't want to be involved in any way. First time I went back and didn't feel any of that was Susie Sainsbury's leaving party. And I went back and I just enjoyed being in Stratford, celebrating the extraordinary contribution that Susie had made to the company in all sorts of ways, meeting lots of old friends, going round the new redeveloped TOP, come courtyard complex, being very touched by how it contained architectural memories of what Tom Piper and I had done there with the histories and other things. And on that night, Greg said, it's time that you should come, and why don't you revisit your Tamburlaine that you did in New York? And it just felt right. And it felt like there was enough time, enough water under the bridge to come back.
Mm. I suppose, was there a sort of strange kind of affinity in terms of the Herculean nature of that play and that, I suppose, the import of that play that sort of spoke to you, I suppose, in the wake of running the RSC, or am I barking very much up the wrong tree?
It was nothing to do with any motivation to do the play. Whether it gave me any understanding of the machinations of power or I've absolutely no idea. But on that, yeah, it's a play about empire destroying every bit as much as it's a play about empire building. It's a play about revolution. And as such, I felt it spoke to our time, both in 2014 when I did it in New York and perhaps even more so this year doing it at the RSC. The moral tale, a sort of beware of the clean new broom, beware of the clean sweep, the powers that be may well be corrupt, moribund, vainglorious, and due for sweeping away. But beware of what you will replace them with. And that's a good moral for any new artistic director. but it's a very important moral for our times. And of course, it was hugely urgent for Marlowe, the Catholic son of a cobbler from Canterbury, who was witnessing the first wave of the cost of the English Reformation. And he wrote this extraordinary two-part masterpiece that cleverly disguised counts the cost of a Protestant Reformation in a moribund Catholic world, and manages also at the same time to be an atheist's tragedy that frightens itself with this vision of almost, if there are no gods, then what's to stop us? And isn't that exciting? And, oh my God, especially in part two, isn't that really frightening and rather lonely?
Because I had, I suppose, rather journalistically, thought that, I suppose, with the threat of the Spanish, England being under siege from Catholic Europe, that it would speak, I suppose, to the perhaps inflated fears of barbarism abroad, and the idea of England standing
the
alone.
Spaniards weren't the barbarians, though. The Spaniards were the extraordinary, they were the state of the art, the Spaniards, the Portuguese, the Italian dukedoms, Venice. They were way ahead economically and culturally of England at the time. And we were scampering after them frantically, interestingly, trying to find a little place by which to enrich ourselves as the English. Whether it was the formation 3 years before he wrote the play of the Levant Company and the opening of trade between Elizabeth and the Ottoman Empire, most interestingly including the exchange of bell metals from confiscated Catholic Church bells for cannon shot for the Turks to use against the Catholics in the Mediterranean. Really amazing, glorious. There's a beautiful letter from Elizabeth to Mehmet, the Sultan, where she's doing a contortion act of explaining how much Protestantism has in common with Islam, that neither believe in the Trinity, both believe in one God, both believe in the scripture above all else, both are contemptuous of idolatry and properly militant against it, more or less saying we're practically the same, so let's open trade, please. Meanwhile, Martin Frobisher Raleigh was trying to find some kind of little foothold in the Americas that the Spanish were totally dominating. And Martin Frobisher was trying to find the Northwest Passage to China. Mm. And that would have been a massive coup if the English, who were completely outgunned, outmaneuvered by the Spanish and the Portuguese in the Latin Americas, the whole search for gold was lost. But if we could get to China quicker than them, that could maybe hugely enrich England and make it much more powerful. And that was maybe our niche. And there's this extraordinary sense of wanting to dominate the globe in that story of Frobisher's, in Raleigh's expeditions, Drake's expeditions, and in the opening up of trade with the Ottoman Empire, and indeed with the Moscow Company opening up trade with Russia. England really making a big push to find its feet against the major powers of the time, Spain and probably Spain and Italy were the major powers.
The colonization instinct in the play then is speaking to that.
Yeah, it's a global
imperial march.
It's a global Protestant dash as well against the equivalents of Bajazeth and Maecetes, the king of Persia, are Philip of Spain and the Doge. Mm. They are the exotic, mighty southern creatures that plucky little Tamburlaine faces, the underdog, England, reformed. England cleared out of all the panoply of mightiness in Europe.
So there is a sense that his rhetoric initially is his armour. I mean, he has a ferocious appetite for warfare, but at the same time his tool, his primary piece of legislation is his tongue. You know, he has that ability to charm and talk in ways that his opponents don't have. And is that also twinned with a sort of national purpose, that the English language is going through a sort of turbulent process of change, and the stage will be the crucible by which England will talk to itself? I don't know, because these things seem to be happening at the same time, don't they?
I think there was an urgency at the time, an England that was in the process of redefining itself from the roots up culturally. There was an urgency to work out who the hell we were. And language was necessary to that. So I think the idea of self-invention through language probably was quite urgent at the time. And the sense of, I suppose, whenever you radically redefine something, you need to find the vocabulary to express what you think the new you is, either as a person or as a nation state. And to some extent, the language that you choose will in turn define what you do become like. Mm. And that actually also feels very modern, very 20th century, very sort of existentialist. It's, that sense of self, the ability to self-define, which was present at the time because it was a revolutionary time, it was a ground zero time, it was reinvent from the ground up, and it was also free of a received language of the Catholic Church, which had been the language of power for as long as anyone could remember.
There's a kind of great cluster of bejeweled verse, isn't there? But I mean, suppose you pampered jades of Asia when Tamburlaine has not just subjugated, but sort of almost slave exploited his opponents. I mean, and they become his horses, his footstools. But what do we know really what those wider worlds, the Asia? I mean, he studied maps, and he's a student, map making. I mean, is it just the great unknown really when he's talking about Asia?
No, I don't think
that planted anything in his audience mind beyond a word, or do people have a concept of that world beyond?
I think the world of the Ottoman Empire was very present in the imagination, probably, of the theatre-going London public. So, yes, it's exotic, but I think I don't think that the Asian world is that much more exotic than, say, the Spanish and Italian world. Interestingly, in 2014, while we were rehearsing, videos were being broadcast of American and British journalists being beheaded by ISIS propagandists. And ISIS was, at that point, mid-conquest. And the Islamic State, the new caliphate, was being quite successful territorially in both Iraq and Syria. We couldn't keep that vision of a new fundamentalism. So the new Islamic fundamentalism, as an analogy for Tamburlaine's new fundamentalism, and the critique that Marlowe has of the hypocrisy of this new fundamentalism, that it will actually shift its spiritual shape to suit itself. It's ultimately the pure political libido of people who want to grab power back. And actually, you know, at the beginning of Tamburlaine's journey, we're fairly sympathetic towards this. Why shouldn't he get his piece of the pie as well as these ridiculous, vicious potentates that he's bringing down? But the presence of those horrible orange jumpsuits and those vicious videos when we were rehearsing in New York reminded us of the perils of any fundamentalist revolution, and in particular of expedient revolution in the name of fundamentalism. And so there was a portrait of a terrifying conclusion to the sort of Calvinist stroke Islamic fundamentalist revolutionary there, and the hope of redemption from that. In 2018, different things were to the front of our minds, such as, I say it is the case, therefore it is the case. And the desire of political leaders like Putin and Trump to their preparedness to really openly declare something to be the case, and their tremendous belief that they can therefore make it the case. And the whole post-truth thing becomes really interesting in a world where a man creates the theatrical illusion of something and it becomes the case right from the get-go. He announces his marriage to Xenocrate, to Theridamas, using her little cache of gold as his theatrical props of persuasion to Theridamas, and it works. It becomes the case. He becomes that much more powerful, and of course more so because now he has 1,000 horsemen on his side, and builds with bullshit, with beautiful bullshit, builds his empire.
Was it seen as difficult even in its day, perhaps, or speculation, I suppose? But
it doesn't seem to have been seen difficult in his day. It seems to have been seen as a great star vehicle, as a great blockbuster. So it was positioned very much within a sort of populist end. Probably, it must have been controversial. It must have had a frisson. The portraits of power, even set safe at a safe distance amongst Scythians, who, we don't know about Scythians then, really. No, we don't really. There's a kind of safety of distance that Shakespeare, first of all, eschewed with the histories, and then quickly, probably with his fingers burnt, I think, retreated into Rome, Italy, far afield. He gave himself the safety of 140 odd years in the histories, but that's about it. Portraits of power and corrupt power, and brutality of power and persecution, were always going to have a frisson in a London where heads were kept on London Bridge to discourage dissidents, especially in theatres that were occasionally used for public executions, especially at a time when the more spectacular of those executions held in public places were every bit as brutal as anything in Tamburlaine. Braining is tame compared to hanging, drawing and quartering. And hanging, drawing and quartering is no worse than the rumours being spread now, the story being put out by the Turkish government of the death of the Washington Post journalist Khashoggi in the Saudi embassy, of him being cut
to pieces while he was alive.
Mm.
Man's inhumanity to man was very much in Marlowe's mind, and probably in the mind of the audience at the time as well.
It was allegedly a problem a while back in terms of the burning of the Quran, the sort of vaunting declaration of defiance to Muhammad in the play. What was your feeling about how you make that, how you honour that on stage in terms of...
Well, for Marlowe, I have absolutely no doubt that along the lines of Faustus, along the lines of Richard III, other great atheists, stroke heretics, this is a great blasphemy on the London stage, rendered safe by being the Quran.
Mm.
What Marlowe was really doing in his deep imagination was burning the Holy Scriptures. That's what he was doing. But it was okay because it was the Quran.
Mm.
Nowadays, it's not okay. But it's nonetheless absolutely crucial that we see Tamburlaine finally having quoted the authority and claimed the authority of God in various kinds, Jove, Muhammad, whoever you like to call it, as he goes through the play, finally entering into war with the heavens by burning Holy Scripture, the ultimate, not just the Protestant, it's just me and God, with no priests and church hierarchy intervening. Mm. No, it's me and God, and do you know what? The whole world's mad, except thee and me, and even thee's a little queer. You know, he's attacking God now.
Mm.
And that would have had a fantastic freestyle in the theatre. And it still does for us.
Mm.
And it was terribly important for us that we did it, and it was terribly important that it was, at the same time, respectful. It was clearly the Quran that we were burning. It was also clear that it was a smoke machine and sheaves of black A4 tissue paper coming from the grid. And also, I did make sure there were no Qurans in those books that were thrown even into the trap. I'm sufficiently superstitious, if you like, in some primitive way,
yes,
to make absolutely sure that there was, you know, there was no holy writ there.
No, no. I don't know whether you've got time to say a few words about Judah Wusu, who takes on this mighty role, a role last played at the RSC in that space by Anthony Scher. And of course, so many of the reviews, 92, talk about him, as it were, hanging upside down and scaling the side of the auditorium.
I first came back to Tamburlaine at the invitation of Geoffrey Horowitz at Theatre for a New Audience in New York with an actor, John Douglas Thompson, hailed by Ben Brantley as the best classical actor of his generation in America, as part of the package. And I went on a journey with John that was glorious. And John is a beast. John is a terrifying beast on stage. He's got the brake horsepower and the battleship guns of a monster. And it was a beautiful performance. My first instinct in 2017, while I was casting, was actually, I need to put John out of my mind. I need to somehow completely get rid of him. And I wanted to cast Tamburlaine white this time. I definitely didn't want to cast him, you know, African British or anything. But I only offered actually one other actor than Jude, and it was Tom Hardy. That were, and that was the only white actor who was, you know, free, you know, was who I could get, I could think, right, okay, he can supplant John for me. Venom got in the way. And as it so happened, when push came to shove, I was already working with Jude as Lupakhin in The Cherry Orchard. Not a likely audition for Tamburlaine, that role, and not really in how he played it, except in one scene. I knew there was a bonfire inside of Jude, and I trusted his moral strength, I trusted his intelligence, and I trusted him to stop at nothing to get to a good place. If you're a black actor in Warwickshire, you're an underdog. You just are. No matter, you know, even if you're famous, you're an underdog. That comes with that. Quite often a lot of really, really good white actors nowadays, young ones, are tending to come from an ever-decreasing bandwidth of cultural experience because of the demise of arts in the schools, the drop by around about 30% of the study of arts in secondary schools, and it's affecting university and college applications. So it's not something that is supported in state schools in the way that it used to be. And you're getting a more and more narrow bandwidth, actually, of actors coming in who aren't from... They're not Scythian shepherds. They really don't know that experience viscerally. If they're good actors, they can play it. But especially if they're young, maybe it's a harder stretch. They haven't lived enough yet. Mm. Also, those who have lived a bit would rather earn more and get much, much, infinitely more exposure in film and television. So actually, it's not necessarily a moral crusade to cast diversely. Sometimes it's the natural result of a changing market. That if you want real excellence on every level, not just technical, but kind of moral and emotional strength, you have to seek elsewhere, especially when you're asking for really quite long contracts for very little money. You are seeking elsewhere amongst people for whom it is a tremendous opportunity. And for some other people, it's an opportunity. Yeah, of course, it would be a lovely thing to do, but maybe there are other things. Maybe there's a much, much smaller part in a Netflix series.
Couple of thoughts. I don't know what you think. I mean, the regional theatre model seems to be under great stress at the moment as a way of training, as a way of innovating. You know, all the corners that could possibly be cut have been cut in terms of the financial element. Do you see your own younger self, as it were, now having a greater struggle to get those early learning experiences under the belt?
I was so lucky and so privileged to spoilt, really, to the extent that I'm having to relearn things now as a freelance director. My God, I got a trainee directorship with the Regional Theatre Trainee Director Scheme, which, thank goodness, is still alive. The television that used to be sponsored by television. But I think there are fewer of them now than there used to be. And I got picked up from that, well, by the theatre decided, okay, we'll keep you on and we'll pay you at the Belgrade. And then I got picked up from the Belgrade by Claire Venables at the Crucible, which was really, really lucky. And then by the end of my time at the Crucible, by the time I left the Crucible, I think I already knew that I had got the job of running the Tron in Glasgow, starting up the Tron Theatre in Glasgow, in an old church building. And then by the time of the end of my time running the Tron for 11 years, I knew that I'd got an associateship at the Royal Shakespeare Company. So I never faced that terror of, well, and just the difficulty of not being able to earn any money. And I see really exciting young directors now, but you know, they're either assisting me or I see small pieces that they manage to do, and how they keep body and soul together. It's really difficult without actually being reasonably well off in the first place. And never mind poor people surviving, middle class people, you know. You know, sons of doctors like me, it's really tricky.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that there's also a sort of mood abroad that the white male director has had ample luck, fortune, and so forth. And there may be a case genuinely for saying there has been this gender dominance and also class dominance. And racial dominance. But
a nice middle class white boy like me starting out, it would be not only a bad economic moment, but it would also be a tricky cultural moment, because yes, the balance of history is being slightly adjusted. And I have sympathy for some of my younger friends whom, not if they moan too much about it, frankly. You know, oh, I'm white and I'm male. But yeah, there is a shift.
A recent article by Lynn Gardner suggested that some, I don't think she named names particularly, but some directors are still allowed to kind of fail upwards, and that you know, that some, I suppose implicitly, white male directors get more breaks in terms of they can move on if they've had a bad night and have another go, and other, whether it's women or from sort of more disadvantaged backgrounds, directors don't get the numerous attempts at the same job. And I just wonder whether you feel that's true or not. Do you think it is more make or break now, that each show is your, could be your last if you're starting out, or we don't have the same tolerance for experiment and failure now in the theatre world?
I think only really to the extent that there's less fat on the bone, there's less meat on the bone, and so yes, it's more pressure. I think it is more pressured. Although in a funny way, you know, it's less conservative perhaps, so maybe people are more open-minded. You know, your community, I think, is actually open to more to the crossing of influences of art forms, and more wary of received orthodoxies about what constitutes good theatre. Just that little bit more cushion, and therefore perhaps a little bit more accepting. But economically, it's much worse. And yeah, I think there probably still is an inherent cultural prejudice against, well, in a field that I've spent a lot of time in, say in classical theatre. Yes, but how strong, you know, how strong are they on the language? You know, if it's someone from another culture, you know, for whom, you know, maybe they're a bilingual Brit or something. I don't know, it's hard. In a way, I think it's quite a hard one for me to judge, because I have not been in the swim now for 6 years. You know, if I was still running the RSC, I would feel this responsibility very strongly, and I would be doing my homework around the play, and having a much better finger on the pulse than I probably have as a selfish freelancer. I think that in some ways, I think things are better, and in some ways, like in the economics of regional theatre, with the evisceration of local government funding, as the single most destructive thing. In the name, you know, most artists are very angry with the Conservative Party for, on the one hand, talking about small government being good, and on the other hand, brutally centralising control in education and culture by eviscerating local hands-on government and holding the reins in the Department of Education and trying to turn the Arts Council into a Ministry of Culture. It's a wicked, wicked thing, and it's a consistent story from way back. Mm. You know, it's not just recent.
Do you see there being a robust and certain future for an institution like the RSC at a time when everyone's fighting for a bit of that cake? The RSC has a huge chunk of it, and perhaps we don't put as much premium on the classical repertoire as we did. I mean, even in the last 10 years, I'd say I've noticed, you know, rightly or wrongly, this could be a good or bad thing, but regions haven't got the resource necessarily or the will ideologically to keep in play those kind of texts that might prove not necessarily as bankable as they once did, and certainly won't particularly attract the star power they might once have done.
Ever since I was a student, I've seen theatre as a vulnerable art form. It's expensive. It is still very class-bound, excessively so. And all institutions need to earn their keep, especially the big ones. I think it's good that the RSC and the National both took a cut this last time round, in order to share the pie around a bit more. I think it's also very important the National is doing quite a lot of work of almost acting as a patron towards smaller companies, and it's something that I tried to do a lot at the RSC. Was that one, you know, we still want, you wanted to have a coherent policy, and you wanted to retain the responsibility and not eschew the responsibility of editorship over what you did, but that could include looking at the likes of Nihai and trying to lure them into classical work, looking at Told by an Idiot, looking at lots of companies, and experimenting with them, giving them facilities to research and so on, and finding room for them in the program, and I effectively sponsoring them, effectively giving them patronage, and I think that's legitimate. And actually, I think it's part of the way forward. I think also that one of the things I'm proudest of at the RSC is that of the major institutions, the RSC still is the one that's doing most through Erica at making real connections with non-professional theatre throughout the UK. And because you can get a bit depressed about the professional scene in some ways, you know, hugely excited in some ways and worried in others. But it's crazy the number of people that are making theatre at any given moment, on any given day, and the number of people that go and see the theatre, if you include the mechanicals. And it's a fantastically vibrant, bursting, surging culture. There's no drop off in school plays or amateur theatre companies. If anything, it's become bigger. So that is cause for great, great confidence.
Theatre Voice is an audio archive about British theatre. You can subscribe to the weekly podcast on iTunes or visit our website, theatrevoice.com, to hear hundreds of interviews with some of the world's leading theatre makers. This episode was presented by Dominic Cavendish and produced by Matt Truman and Helen Gush for the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. Thanks for listening.